From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Wilfred Sheed is a critic and novelist who has satirized the literary world. He's also written a memoir about his parents, Frank and Maisie, who ran an unorthodox Catholic publishing company. On today's Fresh Air, Sheed reflects on his own life and the life of John F. Kennedy, the subject of Sheed's new book. Also today, actress Jane Alexander tells us why she's doing a lot of her work away from the camera as the head of her own production company. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the career of Alex Chilton. Chilton was only a teenager when his group The Box Tops hit it big. Ed says Chilton's still an influence today. And book critic John Leonard has a review of film director Ingmar Bergman's autobiography. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Wilfred Sheed is a well-known figure in the literary world, a world he satirized in his recent novel, The Boys of Winter. His parents, Frank and Maisie, were important figures in a different part of the book world. They ran the iconoclastic Catholic publishing company, Sheed and Ward. They started the company in London in 1926 and moved the company and the family to America in 1933. Although he grew up in a book-obsessed family, Wilfred Sheed's main childhood preoccupation was sports. But he had to give up playing ball when he got polio at the age of 14. That's when he turned to books. Sheed is the author of several novels, a memoir about his parents, and two collections of essays, which include his book reviews. He's been a Book of the Month Club judge since 1973. Sheed wrote the text for the new book, The Kennedy Legacy, A Generation Later, which features photos by one of John F. Kennedy's personal photographers, Jacques Lowe. In the book, Sheed says that he asked himself the question, why were we so impressed with Kennedy at the time? And looking back at Kennedy's life and career, Sheed found himself revising some of his original views.
Well, I had more or less been following the flow, which seemed to be running entirely in a critical direction, and me following along with all the other fish. And it was only when my friend suggested that we do a book, and my first response was, well, I'm really not sure he's worth it. And then we talked. And I realized that I had been accreting opinions that I wasn't so happy with, and I did remember quite enough to write a book about, and indeed a book of celebration. I think that the tendency to level our monuments is, I think, Tocqueville warned us this is a sign of democracy in action, and people simply wanted to bring him down in some way, I felt. Besides, you know, the very good arguments, particularly relating to Vietnam. Vietnam seems a great deal worse because it was made worse by subsequent presidents. As left by Kennedy, it remains something of an enigma.
I would like for you to evaluate Kennedy's speeches from the vantage point of a literary critic. What did you think of his speeches?
Well, I had a certain amount of trouble with the rolling qualities that Sorensen put in. I could see that they were catchy and perhaps necessary. But beyond that, Sorensen really wasn't a bad writer at all if he hadn't taken whatever course in rhetoric that one had to just keep rolling and going any distance and walking any mile and toting that barge, lifting that bale kind of stuff. If you subtract the rather pulverizing lilt, you actually have very good language and clearly very close to what was on Kennedy's mind. I think that the words approximate the thought more than they are normally required to do in political discourse.
Novelist and critic Wilfred Sheed is my guest, and he's written the text for a new book called The Kennedy Legacy, which features photographs by Jacques Lowe. In your book, The Boys of Winter, which is a satire of the literary world, the narrator says at one point that he'd forgotten how dull culture can be in the wrong hands. And he's referring to people sitting around talking about painting. And I wonder who you think the wrong hands are.
Well, in the days when I used to review culture, as it were, I finally came to believe that culture meant you can't smoke. Of course, nowadays you can't smoke anyway, so that's that definition is gone. But there seemed to be something also reminiscent of Bernard Shaw said, an Englishman feels he's being moral when he's only being uncomfortable about culture, that it was a way of coming in from the sunshine on a nice day in order to hear chamber music. It didn't have the joy that the creator himself had. And in fact, I have found that the artists themselves are not great devotees of culture. They're devotees of what they're doing. And I think one of the greatest gaps in the world is between patrons of the arts and artists. I think two more different types of human being can hardly be found.
Would you explain that a little more?
Well, go to a party of fundraisers, the sort of people who regularly support the arts, and just imagine replacing this with a party given by painters for each other. And I think, say no more.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you're talking about patrons, which are just one particular breed of people who are interested in the arts.
What interests me is, though, that the patrons of the arts don't feel any spiritual identification at all. Of course, it's disastrous if they do. If they try dressing like artists, it would look very sad indeed. But they don't see any anomaly between dressing up in this way, mm-hmm. and then making a rather stuffy occasion of art, mm-hmm. Which is in fact produced by a somewhat wild and the sort of man who doesn't sit still
and woman,
yes, oh man and woman, my goodness, yes.
Now you are both a novelist and critic, so you have lived and worked in two different, also often conflicting worlds. You write that as an author, receiving a bad review is like being spit on by a complete stranger in Times Square. Has that feeling ever held you back from writing a bad review?
It finally held me back from writing any reviews at all. I do very, very few these days, at least of living people, because, just to be crass about it, I don't need any more enemies. As a novelist, you really don't need any more than the course of life is going to send you. but also, yes, on humane grounds, I think that that you lose the killer instinct as you go along. I think that criticism can be a blood sport and really to be indulged by the young. As you get old, you imagine that perhaps the person is ill, or you imagine all the situations that have happened to yourself at one time or another, and you really can't go on giving it. You know how much it hurts.
You don't think that criticism plays a higher function than just panning a new book or dishing the writer?
Yes, I suppose when I talk about panning, I really never did enjoy it. People seem to assume that this is the part of their work that critics really enjoy the most, and I suppose, you know, one can indulge oneself in this. There are probably more rich, hostile words in the language than nice ones. But I have really enjoyed writing favorable reviews. So, and actually, I think criticism itself goes way beyond praise and blame. Once you... With criticism as opposed to reviewing is that you assume that the reader is familiar with the work of art or will make himself so, and then you can talk. This is the talk of people who have gone beyond the question of whether it's good or bad and now just want to talk about the thing itself. And that kind of criticism I would still like to do.
Mm-hmm. Wilfred Sheed is my guest, a critic and novelist, and the author of the text for a new book called The Kennedy Legacy. Now, your parents, Frank and Maisie, were the leading Catholic publishers in their time in both the United States and England. Was it intimidating for you to start writing knowing that your parents were important in the world of publishing and religious publishing?
I was intimidated by them, but not because they were publishers, because I knew even then that the very best publishers publish a great deal of bad writing. But I was somewhat intimidated by something my father particularly did, which he wasn't aware of, he was sublimely unaware of, he had a way of suggesting that stuff written by very young people would look silly to them a few years later. He never said it directly in reference to me. He said it in reference to other people. And I picked up the notion, so I wrote nothing but humorous stuff. I was going to say until I was 45, but it wasn't quite that long. But I fell into a habit of writing humorously because I knew that that particular gift is one that peaks early, like lyric poetry. If you take a good college humor magazine, it will be as sophisticated as those men will ever get. Whereas if they attempt a serious magazine, they will get a good deal better if they're going to be any good.
I've never thought of humor as something that peaks early. It's an interesting way to look at it.
I think if you take the great American humorists, you know, be they Perelman, Thurber, Benchley, they all had their primes before 40,
mm-hmm.
and indeed began to sweat after.
Well, you were very athletic when you were growing up, and you didn't much like books. That changed, I think, when you got polio when you were, I believe, 14 years old. Were you surprised when you were ill to find that you actually enjoyed reading?
No, I had done a little furtive reading before that.
Furtive, huh?
Yes. It was the difference between...
You were hiding it from friends or parents?
Oh, from friends. Mm-hmm. No, from... For parents, I would I would strut it, but the sort of friends I knew were not readers themselves, and they really didn't. This was if you can be macho at the age of 10, that's what we were, by golly, and you weren't going to read more than the other fellow. Although of course there were certain approved texts, comic books were perfectly all right, but. It was the difference you get from reading constantly. Suddenly the whole thing starts flowing together. Instead of being a passage here and a passage there, you are seeing the whole sea at once. When you read, I remember reading An Evelyn Waugh a day until I'd gone through, you know, the pre-war ones. And the same with the Graham Greene thrillers. And reading at that speed gives you a much different... A much sharper and fuller picture of the object read.
Your parents sent you to Warm Springs when you had polio, which was the place that FDR went to. And when you got there, you thought of it as a gigantic hoax. This is the place that there were waiting lists for people with polio to be sent to. Your parents managed to get you in. Why did it seem like a gigantic hoax to you?
Well, because it was. I mean, it didn't just seem like one then. It seems like one today as I look back on it. The subject almost asked for a hoax because people who have polio will believe in anything. And this was the closest secular version to faith healing that could be imagined. And part of the mythology depended on the fact that Roosevelt always concealed his own legs. And therefore, we felt somehow that Warm Springs had cured him. And if you have the will to believe to that extent, you don't look under the table. And so it went with us that my family and I tried quackier cures than that. This at least was respectable. No harm came to you from it. And at the end of it, they simply resigned you to having polio. You were surrounded by other people with it. You did see people in much worse straits than yourself. And at the end of it, you thought, well, this is a way of life. It had become normal to you to see people in this state.
You also write that the experience left you suspicious of organized charity and tear-jerking posters.
Well, yes, in this particular case, for instance, they showed this young fellow in a brace, and he went on year after year wearing his brace. I should have suspected something about him. But they simply find the most pathetic and photogenic subject they can. And once upon a time, I worked for Bishop Fulton Sheen in a mission organization, and we used to run pictures of lepers. And we would get protests from the the leprosy people to saying, we really have leprosy pretty well in hand. What good are these posters doing? to which we could only say, well, they're pretty. In a fundraising way, ugly is pretty. And never mind information of any sort. If the picture is pathetic enough, you'll assume these people have a cure for it. It's mesmerizing.
And you didn't object to these ads?
Well, I objected, and I didn't stay very long. Uh-huh. But I didn't object very strenuously because they did raise money for quite different things. I mean, the money did not go to leper colonies because we couldn't find any. But the money did go to very worthy things, but of a rather dull nature. If you showed a picture of a priest in China going his rounds, you wouldn't draw flies. But you show someone dying of gangrene, and you will pack the house.
Did polio have any lasting physical effects on you?
Yes, I still have a limp, and I was a sort of borderline case. I was still able to swing a golf club, although not walk the length of a golf course, things of that sort. So I got a bit of everything. I had an absolutely wicked serve at ping pong. And just enough, once again, as Warm Springs had finessed the trauma of the thing, then being able to take part in things has finessed the rest. So I can't say that at any stage that this was a terrible, shattering experience.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. Wilfred Sheed is my guest. He's a novelist, essayist, and his latest book is titled The Kennedy Legacy. He wrote the text for a book that also includes photographs by Jacques Loeb. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest writer Wilfred Sheed has written books of essays, biographies of Muhammad Ali and Claire Booth Luce, several novels, including last year's The Boys of Winter, which is a satire of the literary world. Now, you had said right before our break that that polio wasn't as traumatic an experience for you as we might have thought. Do you think it finally led to your being a writer, since it forced you away from athletics and got you more inside the world of books?
I think it probably made me a different kind of writer. I think I probably would have wound up writing whatever happened, although I had at that age pictured myself as a lawyer. That sounded as if it covered just about everything, and even conceivably as a politician, because I think it would be slightly abnormal for someone of 14 to picture himself sitting at a desk all day. I suppose the halfway house, the image that brought most of us towards writing was that of a sort of Hemingway who was covering wars in between books.
You moved to the United States at the age of 9 with your parents, and they were coming here to start an American branch of their publishing company, their Catholic publishing house. And you say that there was nothing about skyscrapers and Hollywood that prepared you for the Catholic Church in America. What was so astonishing about the Catholic Church in America compared to the church in England that you were used to?
Well, I, of course, being 9 years old, wasn't very used to anything at that point. And I certainly hadn't sampled the Catholic Church in England to any sort of extent. The Catholic Church in America was different from any kind of experience, be it religious or be it otherwise. But it would take me books and books. In fact, I did write a book about my parents in which I tried to tangle with this question, but the difference could not be summed up in a couple of phrases.
You say that having a church in your backyard is like owning a theater. Would you explain that a little bit?
Well, yes, I suppose you felt that it was a family show that was being put on, and the parish priest was, of course, a very close friend. He used to I believe he taught me how to bowl a cricket ball, that sort of thing, and then we'd all troop into church together and play that particular role. And a very small child isn't really aware of what being in church is about. So it parallels other things, and family theatricals would be about the closest. And then I became an altar boy, which meant that I actually got to dress up for the part. And I swung one of those incense thurible's, and felt no end of a performer as a result.
So your family felt something like a showbiz family to you?
Well, again, I had nothing to compare it with, but I guess I did get a somewhat more colorful feeling about my family than most people would have about theirs. And as I say, I was probably the hammiest altar boy who ever genuflected.
Did you ever rebel against Catholicism?
No, that's a hard one to say, because I remember I decided at the age of 16 or so, maybe even earlier, that I wasn't going to leave the church over sex. I thought that the church was about something more important than that, and that actually took the starch out of any rebellion, because that's actually what makes rebellion really hum, is that it's powered by a sexual drive. And I thought the church doesn't seem to me to make any sense about sex, but then neither does anybody else. I mean, the thing seemed to me quite insoluble if people are born able to procreate at 13 or so and then have somehow to manage this so that they can raise children. You're going to have ridiculous solutions to it. And I decided the church was really about encounter with God and that sort of thing, and that the sex thing I would think about it when I was too old to care, perhaps.
When you said that you decided you weren't going to leave the church over sex, did that mean that you would follow the church's teachings on sex and therefore not leave, or that you would ignore the church's teachings, follow what you thought about it, and not leave the church?
Well, in those days, it would be nice to think that I thought, yes, I'll keep my fingers crossed about this. That, of course, is what one would do now. At the time, I must say that caused a good deal of grief. And again, this would take more time than we've got. But I believe I was getting more out of the plus side of religion than I was losing to the negative. And there were periods when I decided to let I would go for as many months between confessions as it was legally possible to do. And I had the usual joke situations where one had to pretend one had felt dizzy instead of going up to communion. It all sounds so richly comic, and it was so richly tragic at the time. I suppose that it wouldn't have been so funny if we hadn't been so serious about it.
What's the role of Catholicism in your life now?
Well, as whoever it was said, they'll have to throw me out. I still find myself very comfortable with the notion of a universal Christianity as opposed to a localized one. And again, the matter of interpretation would not only take a long time, but I could almost guarantee it would bore you.
You first came to America when you were 9. You returned to England to go to prep school, then returned back to the United States. When did you stop feeling like a foreigner in America?
That took a long time. I suppose, actually, when I had children. And my children weren't foreigners. And then I knew that I couldn't very well be myself. Also, of course, people stop noticing an English accent, and then it really takes...
You don't have a very strong one.
Actually, I have a stronger one electronically than I have in real life, I believe, because my son first heard me on radio when he was very small and said, "Well, you're English," which had never occurred to him before.
When you were young and had just come to America from England, was it considered a feat to have a British accent?
With the guys I ran with, yes, it was definitely a feat. These were tended to be Irish Catholics. My natural colleagues in life are Irish Catholics, and I've had to make my peace with them. And I was not only stuck with a plummy Cockney accent, but also a ridiculous first name.
Oh, Wilfred. Did you try to shorten it to Fred or Willie?
I managed to impose Bill on as many people as I could, but then my parents would come around and say, "Oh, Wilfred," and then I'd have to start all over again.
Did you try for a Brooklyn or New York accent when you were young?
Well, I wanted an American one. I myself thought English sounded very silly, and I thought it sounded very nice when girls spoke it, but hopelessly effete when boys spoke it. And I know many people would go out of their way to speak with an English accent. Well, I went out of my way not to. It was really a safety device. It was a life-saving one, as far as I was concerned. Was not to say coffee or third, or not, in fact, not to talk like Governor Keene or Kane.
What about your writing? Do you think of your writing as having more of an American or of an English accent?
Well, I decided after I read Thurber, I'd gone back to England and was out of sorts about the whole thing. And then I read the Thurber Carnival, and I thought, that's what I want to write like. And so I would credit Thurber with making me want to write American rather than English.
Mm-hmm.
But then, naturally, the other stuff comes in the back door, and I will find I'm using English locutions and an English vocabulary. But it's on an American spine, or at least I trust so.
Are you still on the board of the Book of the Month Club?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been on it?
15 years.
It's a long time.
Yes.
I've always wondered what the qualifications are for a book to make it into the Book of the Month Club. How do you read it? What are you looking for when you're judging it for getting in?
I would say accessible quality. I mean, it's got to be good, but it's also got to... Actually, my father referred to his publishing house, Sheed and Ward, as aiming at a spot just above the middle of the brow. And I suppose that might be the spot that we're still aiming at. From a very high eminence, and from an academic eminence, it will seem middle brow. And from underneath, it will seem just a little bit above. But in fact, well, Graham Greene, an Updike, a Bellow, these we take as a matter of course. So I think middle brow is a little bit harsh.
Have you ever been in the Book of the Month Club yourself?
No, as a judge, I am banned for life from this.
I know that the politics of book reviewing has made you uncomfortable over the years. What about the politics of serving on the board of the Book of the Month Club? It's a lucrative deal for any author who gets in. You're likely to get a lot of sales out of an arrangement like that.
Yes, I always picture myself as a bank teller who hands out millions of dollars every day and then goes back to his garret.
Wilfred Sheed, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And my guest has been essayist and novelist Wilfred Sheed, and he's just written the text for a new book titled The Kennedy Legacy, A Generation Later, which features photographs by Jacques Lowe. It's published by Viking. Sheed is also the author of the literary satire The Boys of Winter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director and screenwriter Paul Schrader. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and the new film, The Last Temptation of Christ. He also directed the new film, Patty Hearst, which is based on Hearst's book about her kidnapping by the Symbionese Liberation Army. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You're probably familiar with actress Jane Alexander from her portrayal of Eleanor Roosevelt in Eleanor and Franklin, her Emmy Award-winning role in Playing for Time, and her supporting roles in movies such as Kramer vs. Kramer and All the President's Men. Coming up, Jane Alexander tells us about a new role in her movie career. She's now a producer, making movies she won't necessarily act in. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Alex Chilton. He started out with the Box Tops. Today, Chilton's still an influence on such bands as R.E.M. and the DBs. And book critic John Leonard reviews Ingmar Bergman's autobiography, The Magic Lantern. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. NASA officials say the Soviet Union has rejected a U.S. offer to help bring down a troubled Soyuz spacecraft with two cosmonauts on board. The spacecraft was forced to abort re-entry today because of malfunctioning equipment. Another attempt to return the craft to Earth is scheduled later tonight. The spacecraft was returning from the orbiting Mir space station when problems developed. The ship reportedly has enough life support and food supplies for 2 days. Soviet news reports say the cosmonauts are not in any immediate danger. The Israeli army today sealed off a West Bank town near Tel Aviv. Soldiers cut telephone communications, rerouted traffic, and arrested about 150 Palestinians. Jim Letterman has details.
Israeli military sources called the operation the biggest offensive undertaken by the Israeli army since the Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories began last December. Israeli General Amram Mitzna says the purpose of the operation was to lower the level of violence in the area and the number of attacks on passing cars, which he said had reached intolerable levels. Israeli radio reported that in house-to-house searches, weapons like knives and axes were found, together with leaflets from the local neighborhood committees. The main objective of the searches would appear to be to try and break the local neighborhood committees, the ad hoc groups formed to direct the local protest activities. The Israelis apparently want to send a message to similar committees in other towns. For the past month, the Israelis have been trying to break the organizational backbone of the uprising, and the committees are a central part of it. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
Iraq said today that it will resume its war with Iran if the Iranians search Iraqi ships. Iran has claimed the right to intercept Iraqi-bound ships until a formal peace agreement is signed. Freedom of navigation is one of the main issues holding up peace talks aimed at ending the 8-year-old Iran-Iraq war. Iraq also announced that it would grant full amnesty to Kurdish rebels after a series of attacks against Kurdish positions inside Iraq. The amnesty decree called on some 100,000 Kurdish rebels and civilians to return to the country. They fled following a 6-week Iraqi offensive launched to punish the Kurds for their support of Iran during the Gulf War. Reagan administration officials announced today that they will oppose international development projects that damage fragile wetlands in developing nations, a policy long urged by U.S. environmental groups. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling has more.
The new policies released today reflect what some environmentalists say is the Reagan administration's most successful and committed environmental protection program. For the last couple years, partly because environmental groups have prodded them, Treasury Department officials have been ordering its representatives at the World Bank to vote against projects that damage the environment. U.S. officials, for instance, have already gotten the World Bank to pressure Brazil to change dam and road projects that were destroying rainforest. Today's new policy will apply specifically to wetlands in the Third World, those fast-disappearing swampy areas along bays and oceans where fish and birds breed. Some environmentalists estimate that in countries like Ecuador, agriculture and construction projects destroy 10% of the wetlands each year. Under the new Treasury policy, U.S. officials will work with international development banks and with government officials in affected countries to boost local economies in ways that protect wetlands. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
Mail is piling up in Great Britain, where a week-long strike by postal workers continues with no end in sight. The strike began August 31st as a one-day walkout to protest bonuses being paid to new workers in southeast England, where recruitment is difficult. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 10 points, closing at 2065.26. Advances led declines 6-5 in trading of 122 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Alex Chilton was only 16 when he and his group, the Box Tops, got their first hit on the pop charts. But early success has its drawbacks. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Chilton may be the best American example of a boy genius who couldn't handle his fame.
For many of the people who play it, rock and roll is rebellion. But rebellion can take odd forms depending on where and when it takes place. In Memphis in the mid-60s, rock and roll rebellion was already in its third generation. Elvis's generation and the generation of blue-eyed soulsters who came next thought it was cool to be white and sound black. But by 1965, when Alex Chilton started writing songs, it was much cooler to want to be British.
Won't you let me walk you home from school? Won't you let me meet you at the maybe Friday I can get tickets for the dance. Now take you. Ooh.
Alex Chilton wrote 13 when he was, well, 13. And although he makes fun of the song's innocence today, it's striking evidence of a strong talent. It took him a while to find an outlet for it, but he and his band, the Box Tops, finally connected with Dan Penn, a producer and songwriter who later worked with Aretha Franklin and Elvis.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
The first song the Box Tops cut was The Letter, and it was an instant number one hit, even showing up on the soul charts. In 1967, amidst the scary psychedelic things, it was a perfect, safe pop song. The Box Tops recorded and toured, and Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys said Alex Chilton was his favorite white vocalist. When they had a second smash, Cry Like a Baby, they were set. Alex was already out of control. He'd discovered drugs, alcohol, and women, and suddenly he didn't sound so innocent.
I met her in church. I met her in church. On a Sunday morning, she looked at me with eyes of love as a choir sang her head.
Next to Aretha's Son of a Preacher Man, I can't think of a more carnal song about religion. But the Box Tops really blew it when Dan Penn got cocky enough to have them record an ode to prostitutes in 1969.
Sweet cream ladies, forward march, the world owes you a living. Sweet cream ladies, do your part, think of what you're giving.
It was just as well. The band was on its last legs, and although he enjoyed being a star, Chilton wasn't doing what he wanted. So Alex moved to L.A., where he lived in Beach Boy Dennis Wilson's place in Topanga Canyon, took guitar lessons from Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, and moved out when he decided he didn't like Dennis's new roommate, Charlie Manson. Back in Memphis, Chilton hung out, played with various people, and finally joined a band called the Icebreakers, led by Chris Bell, a remarkable guitarist. Alex and Chris started writing great songs together, and they renamed the band Big Star, an in-joke for Memphians who know the grocery chain of the same name.
Oh.
but the mixture of punkish roughness and seamless smooth pop was all too close to what was really going on. And after releasing one album and playing one gig, Big Star broke up. Well, for a while they did. They reformed in 1973 to play one show for a bunch of writers. I was there, in fact. And the group liked it so much, they decided to try again. Good thing they did, because they recorded one of the classic pop songs of all time, a record that continues to inspire songwriters, September Girls.
September Girls, did so much. I was your butch, and you were touched.
Such perfection, however, rarely made it to the stage, and by the end of 1974, Big Star was no more. Since then, Alex Chilton has been in and out of the music business, always outrageous and sometimes breathtaking in his grasp of pop music. Along the way, he's inspired Southern bands from the DBs to REM and acquired a fanatical following in Europe. His rebellion has not been without a price, but the least you can say is he's done it the way he wanted. My thanks to Ked H. Benjamin, Chilton fanatic, for research and tapes.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Actress Jane Alexander has made her mark not as the glamorous leading lady, but as a character actor, convincingly portraying a wide variety of roles. She was first critically acclaimed in the late 60s for her role opposite James Earl Jones in the Broadway production of The Great White Hope. She won a Tony Award for her portrayal of the mistress of a black prizefighter. A wider audience was introduced to Alexander through her portrayal of Eleanor Roosevelt in the made-for-TV movie Eleanor and Franklin. On TV, she also played the unsympathetic concentration camp orchestra conductor in Playing for Time. In the movies, she was Dustin Hoffman's neighbor in Kramer vs. Kramer, the Republican bookkeeper in All the President's Men, and in Testament, she starred as a mother trying to care for her family following a nuclear attack. She just completed a run in a Broadway revival of Tennessee Williams' play Night of the Iguana. And this week, she'll star in the made-for-TV movie Open Admissions on CBS. But Alexander now does a lot of her movie work away from the camera. A few years ago, she formed her own production company.
I started to either imagine stories or hear about stories that were true that I wanted told, and I found nobody who would take them on. So I said, well, this is something that I'm going to try to take on then. So that's how it started. The other thing that happened was I was in my starting to be in that middle age for actresses in your 40s where there aren't really the roles anymore because the leading roles are mostly played by women in their 20s or 30s. And I wasn't quite ready yet for the older leading woman roles. And in fact, I didn't even look it yet. So I found a dearth of good roles, particularly in film. And some in television. And so it left time for me to put some energy in this area of producing.
What's going on here? Why aren't there more good roles for women in their 40s? Does this say something about how American society treats women in their 40s now? Or is it more theatrical than that?
No, I think it has to do, it's a reflection of the culture itself. It's not that women in their 40s aren't terrific and women in their 50s and certainly a lot of attention is being paid to women and men in our society who are getting older because we're becoming more and more populous. But The society thinks that women should remain younger, hence the dedication to cosmetic surgery and all kinds of bodily care that women past a certain age feel they have to devote themselves to. So it is the impetus and is toward being younger.
Are you already thinking when you're in your 50s if you will be expected to get your eyelids tucked or whatever the procedure is?
Well, I've already been asked by a number of people to, why wouldn't I consider doing a little tuck here and a little tuck there? But frankly, Terry, I'm such a scaredy cat when it comes to hospitals and surgery that I'm never going to be a candidate, I'm afraid.
Well, does it go beyond that, too, that you don't want to be part of that trend toward cosmetic surgery?
Well, I'm not, frankly, interested in it. I've never been a person that has been vain in any way. Perhaps I should have devoted more care to that, but I never was, and I was never known as an actress who was going to be considered for the very beautiful roles anyway. So I've always leaned towards the more character roles, and I'm not uncomfortable in them.
We know it's interesting. The role that introduced you to a lot of viewers was your role as Eleanor Roosevelt in the made-for-TV movie Eleanor and Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in that, like Eleanor Roosevelt, you had to look very plain and somewhat awkward, mm-hmm. buck teeth, receding chin. And I was wondering if you felt that that gave you the image for a while of being plain, of reading plain on screen.
Well, I was then offered a number of roles of awkward or ugly ducklings who become swan types. Through the next few years. But I was always seeking at that time to change that image because I feel as an actress that I can really play almost anything that the role demands. I mean, I don't mean that as a matter of hubris. I mean it as craft. Through the years, I've developed my craft. So, in fact, if I had to play somebody who was very beautiful, I feel that I could do that very easily as well.
As a producer now, have you had to learn how to sell yourself and sell your production in a way that's different from the way an actress has to sell herself?
Oh, it's very different. It's a totally different ball game. And in some ways, I enjoy that because it is a whole new business that I'm going into, and it is show business, and it is marketing, and it's very, very different from the relatively quiet and reflective life of an actor. When you get into the world of trying to sell a product, and film is a product in the world today, you have to get money for your product in order to make it. You begin to understand when you're on the other side of the fence and you're producing something what it means to have somebody with a name. And I can look at everything far more objectively now.
I'd like to ask you a few questions about some of your movies.
Mm.
In the movie Testament, mm-hmm. you played a mother who is trying to keep her three children alive right after a nuclear bomb has dropped nearby, and bombs have been exploding at least all over the West Coast, and there's even no place to escape to. What effect did it have on you to go to work every day and have to act out the role of someone who is surviving a nuclear war?
Well, it was, as we say, a heavy film to make, but everybody who was making it was there because they wanted to be there. For myself, it was deja vu because I had been suffering from a nightmare years prior to doing the film that involved myself and three of our boys coming out of the woods and discovering people evacuating north, thousands of people. And in the nightmare, which I had about a dozen times, the boys and I ultimately succumbed to radiation poisoning and die. So when I came to do the film, I felt like I had experienced all these emotions before, and in fact I had in my head, in my nightmare.
When you're acting a role, do you take that role home with you, or does it end when the performance ends for the day?
It never ends when I'm involved in something. I've been trying to work on this because it's a pretty frightful thing to inflict on your family and friends if you're playing a murderess or somebody who has rather evil thoughts. In a miniseries I did called Blood and Orchids, I play a really thoroughly evil woman. And when I made that film, I was particularly nasty to the director. And it's not like me to be that way, but I found myself, you know, calling him a bit of a fool for not dealing with me first rather than the other people in the film and stuff like that. And it really was my character. And this has happened to me over and over again. My husband is always able to point it out to me. And my children, too.
So what do you do, go around explaining, well, which part is you and which part is your character?
No, because I'm not fully conscious of it. It's just, it's something that people who are close to me can point out. For example, one time in an off-Broadway show, I played a woman who used obscenities a great deal. Well, my language became so vile around the house that even the teenage boys that were in my house had to say, "Wow, Mom, stop that. That's really disgusting."
Well, Jane Alexander, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Actress Jane Alexander. She stars in the made-for-TV movie Open Admissions this Thursday evening on CBS. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up today, reports about the Soviet satellite that's in orbit and is having some trouble re-entering the atmosphere. We'll find out what's going on there. There are some news reports saying that the cosmonauts aboard have only 2 days left of air or food. Also, reports on the political campaigns. Linda Wertheimer with the Dukakis campaign in Chicago and Jim Angle following Vice President Bush's presidential campaign in the Pacific Northwest. We'll also have a report from reporter Jackie Leiden about a federal prison in Lexington, Kentucky that was closed this summer. Its critics claimed that the only point of the prison was to break people of their unpopular political beliefs. Those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Ingmar Bergman is one of the most enigmatic film directors of our time. His first movie, made in 1945, was titled Crisis. And in the more than three dozen films he's made since, films like Persona, Wild Strawberries, and Cries and Whispers, Crisis, along with Memory, Death, and Despair, has maintained its place. Bergman has just written an autobiography called The Magic Lantern. Book critic John Leonard says it's illuminating.
In an autobiography of prose, close-ups, fade-outs, and jump cuts, as fitful and fragmented as modern consciousness itself, Ingmar Bergman tells us he grew up on guilt and masks, ghosts and Strindberg. Death, instead of a cuckoo, popped out of the gilt clock under the glass dome on the bulging bureau, with its gold fittings and feet in the family dining room. His first memory is of vomiting. Because of masturbation, he was punished by Jesus with pimples. My prayers stank of anguish, entreaty, trust, loathing, and despair, he writes. God spoke, God said nothing. He hated his older brother, tried to kill his younger sister, and refused to go to the hospital when his father, who had wanted to sell him to the gypsies, was dying of cancer. He loved, instead of his mother, steam engines, fairy tales, Chinese shadow theater, and a toy box for projecting images with a paraffin lamp, a Maltese cross, and a reflecting mirror. Years go by, and he almost never sees his many children by his several wives and mistresses, and when he does, they won't speak to him. His own health is usually lousy. Twice he tells us, "I was so ill it was almost interesting." When he sleeps, he's afflicted by loathsome dreams. Murder, torture, suffocation, incest, destruction, insane anger. Insomnia is worse. "Flocks of black birds come and keep me company," he writes. Anxiety, rage, shame, regret, boredom. On the other hand, he has decided that a guilty conscience is an affectation, because my torment could never make up for the damage I had done. When the Swedish tax collector takes after him, he suffers a nervous breakdown, then moves to Munich, where they hate him, even though as a schoolboy, one summer in Germany between world wars, he'd been just as excited as everybody else by Nazi spectacle. He's too tired, too scared to make any more movies after Fanny and Alexander. Quote, "Sometimes I perceived clearly, almost physically, a primeval monster, half beast, half man, moving inside me to which I was about to give birth. One morning I was chewing on a rough, evil-smelling beard. I had an inkling of a twilight, which had nothing to do with death, but with extinction." He asks his mother, "Were we given masks instead of faces? Hysteria instead of feelings? Shame and guilt instead of love and forgiveness?" But his mother's slim body sinks into the pattern of the counterpane. She has been dead for years. There are wicked stories in this memoir of Charlie Chaplin, Olivier, and Garbo, and inside info on the secret sources of such movies as Persona and The Seventh Seal, and theories on acting and direction, writing and money, sex and opera. But The Magic Lantern is really an astonishing literary document of auto-analysis and self-laceration, of Lear-like rage and burning images, and a madness to see through the world to an absent God. The greatest movie director of our time found in film as dream, film as music, the only cure for his dread of the dark. "The mute or speaking shadows turn without evasion towards my most secret room," he says. "The smell of hot metal, the wavering, flickering picture, the rattle of the Maltese cross, the handle against my hand. All this from a little boy afraid to die."
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Ingmar Bergman's autobiography, The Magic Lantern. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I speak with writer Clarence Major. He's one of America's leading black writers and one of the few black American novelists writing experimental fiction. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new home video of one of the most celebrated live specials in the history of television, the Ford 50th Anniversary Show. It aired in 1953 and featured a 12-minute duet with Ethel Merman and Mary Martin performing the songs they made famous in musical comedies. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.